Nanotechnology, technology conducted on the molecular scale, has been with us for a few decades, and it's become part of our everyday lives. Nanotechnology helps create materials used in clothing and cosmetics, computers and golf balls. It's what they'll be talking about at the annual Nanotechnology Workshop tomorrow and Friday at the University of Illinois Urbana campus. The university's Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology puts on the workshop every year. And two faculty members with the center are joining us on Focus today. We'll talk about the benefits of nanotechnology, about how there are things you can do with molecules that you can't do with the materials made out of them. We'll talk about what may come from nanotech research in the future and what may just be hype. I'm Jim Meadows, Nanotechnology on Focus. Coming right up after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Nanotechnology, a word using the prefix nano, it means 1/1,000,000th of, in the case of, say, a nanometer, 1/1,000,000th of a meter, just slightly larger than an atom, I understand. And there are units of measurement, by the way, that are even smaller, which might come in handy for you someday. But a nanometer is useful in nanotechnology, which actually works with substances down on that scale. And just how that is done is something that's been a regular topic of discussion on Focus over the past 10 years. We're looking at it again as the University of Illinois gets ready to host its annual workshop on nanotechnology that's coming up tomorrow and Friday. Irfan Ahmad is an agricultural engineer, and he serves as the executive director for the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at the University of Illinois. He does his research at the Department of Agricultural and Biological Engineering and the College of Engineering. And Placid Ferreira is a faculty member with the center, also an engineer, and he heads the Department of Mechanical Science and Engineering at the College of Engineering. And Professor Ahmad, Professor Ferreira, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having us.
You know, one thing that comes to mind, you know, I think you've both been working in this field for several years, and I'm just wondering, I can imagine if you're making a pitch, say, for a grant application, you might tell about all the things that can be done with nanotechnology. I'm wondering what makes it exciting for you personally. If, and maybe I can start with you.
With me?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So I'm very excited with any new technology as an engineer. I mean, it's an exciting part. And looking back about 10 years ago, when I was offered this position coming from an agricultural biological engineering standpoint, the most exciting part was that its potential applications in agriculture and food areas, which held a lot of promise and still continue to hold promise, where I would envisage in terms of conducting or carrying out environment-friendly agriculture. And when we talk about the pesticide applications and fertilizers and those sort of issues, we see that there is a role for nanotechnology in managing that aspect. Not only that, but also on the food aspect of it, when we talk about all these E. coli and Salmonella outbreaks. So how can we put in point of test sensors, point of care sensors out in the field so that such outbreaks can be checked at the source? So and then as we went through the nanotechnology initiation, so to speak, among the other areas that we see a lot of potential is in the medical and pharma and in healthcare field, where it will have an impact, and more recently on advanced manufacturing and energy, and colleague Placid Ferreira would be able to comment on that part too.
Well, Placid, maybe you can talk to that as well. What's been personally giving you a thrill in the field of nanotechnology?
Well, I come at this from the point of view of manufacturing. And when you look at, you know, manufacturing, making things, nature has been assembling atoms and molecules for us through the ages. And then we got busy doing the same thing with the Bronze Age and then through the Industrial Revolution, we've started assembling things together and structuring materials and so forth. But in all these processes, you go straight from the atomic scale to roughly the micro scale. So when you look at an industrial process, for example, casting, where we pour metals, you know, we might create metals and we are assembling atoms, but we're only controlling the microstructure of the material. That is to say, you're working, you might control the rate at which, let's say, the metal crystallizes into grains, and those grains might be of the order of 10 microns to about 100 microns, the width of your hair. What nanotechnology allows you to do is it now allows you to control the structure of matter, the structure of material at a submicron scale. And that opens up a whole bunch of new possibilities. For example, as soon as you get into the submicron regime, you're pretty much playing at the wavelength of light. So you can do unusual things with light. So you can see immediate applications in physics. When you start making things very, very small, the surface area of a particle dominates its volume. And as a result of that, you have a highly reactive surface. And so you can mess around with the chemical properties of a substance. Similarly, when you're very small, you don't have any internal defects. And when you reduce the number of defects, you change the mechanical properties of things. So this sort of fundamentally opens up a new way of how you make things, how you design things, and how you exploit these properties that come out of the fact that things are very, very small.
Well, we welcome you to the conversation about nanotechnology as well. Just call with your questions and comments at 333-9455, toll free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. And I'm about to ask you a question. Considering all the shows that have been done on nanotechnology, this probably always comes up. How do you work with things at the molecular and even atomic scale? How do you see them? How do you handle them? It's not like you can get down there on a workbench with pliers and screwdrivers and move things around, is it?
So, I mean, the chemistry is all been at the nanoscale, and this current wave of nanotechnology interest stems from the recent discoveries in some of the instrumentation which has come about, like the scanning. We are talking about 1980s and late 1980s.
Okay.
Scanning electron microscope and then atomic force microscope and other such tools which have come about. So when we are talking about the nanoscale, so we are talking about, say, if you were to visualize it as a soccer ball is to the Earth in size, nanoparticle is to the soccer ball. So that's the size scale that we are talking about. Or your single-strand DNA is equal to 2.5 nanometer. So that is not visible through naked eye, and you would use some of these advanced tools to actually look at them and manipulate them. And sometimes it's also called atomic technology, so that you are able to make things, devices and processes from bottom up. And so you can engineer. And at that, as mentioned by colleague Preston Ferreira, that you could then have different properties of these materials which would go well in developing a device or the desired properties that you would seek in a sensing device and so on and so forth.
What's the advantage of working from the bottom up in changing changing the nature of a molecule?
Maybe I can come back to the first question.
Okay.
So You don't expect to see or feel one of these nanostructures. They're smaller than the wavelength of light. At least when we talk about the wavelength of light, I'm talking about the visible spectrum. So you don't expect to actually see it.
You can't see. You're not going to see it. Yeah. You can't get a visible readout directly of them, but can you get some sort of sense of them?
Right. So you go into what the ultraviolet range and then into the X-ray range of the spectrum so that you can begin to interact with some of these particles. Nevertheless, when assembled in structures, the sort of emergent behavior, the interaction of these structures as an ensemble with light can produce signals and can tell you something about the dimensions and so forth. So that's primarily how you work with it. Okay. So coming back to the question, what did you say?
Well, I mean, the question I just asked you,
this question.
Well, what's the advantage of working from the bottom up, of working from that atomic level? Because eventually, if you're going to use this in technology and in manufacturing, you can't just build one molecule. You're going to have to build a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes people do talk about building things one molecule at a time, and, you know, that would take a very, very long time. Many of you in your science class might have heard of Avogadro's number, which is roughly of the order of 10 raised to 23. So you're not going to individually assemble them together. Nevertheless, people do think in terms of assembly of individual molecules, but they think in terms of highly parallel processes. So, for example, if you think of a chemical reaction, it's a highly parallel process where, you know, one molecule is reacting with one other molecule at a time, but there are bunches of them all put together, and they react together to create a particular kind of a substance. Now, the reason why you want to work at these small scales is because you can exploit very, very small forces to begin to structure these so-called atoms or the so-called molecules or compounds as they're forming. One very good example is the use of block copolymers. So these are just two polymers that don't necessarily mix together or don't like mix together. And when you get them and you put them in the same mix, they tend to sort of precipitate out in structures that have a sort of nanoscale dimension to them. And so you can build these large structures in parallel over large surfaces with a kind of a topology that has a nanoscale feature to it. So these are the sorts of processes that people use to actually create useful nanostructures.
How do you ramp that up, if that's the right word, to manufacturing?
So I just gave you one example. One is a highly parallel sort of process, right? The second approach that you might use is, for example, using light. So lithography, as it's been used in the microelectronics process, is essentially a highly parallel process again. And here what you're doing is you're managing the interaction between a photon of light and a molecule in a chemical to basically get a highly localized reaction, and then you're using that reaction to create a so-called physical structure. So you're changing the state from, let's say, a liquid state to a solid phase.
What's become common in terms of, you know, the application of nanotechnology? Are there things that people are seeing or using every day which are a result of nanotechnology?
So, yeah, you have about 1,000 or so commercially available products which have some sort of nanoscale phenomena in them, either in the development or processing of it. Among the things that we could quickly think of are in the textile, your current stain-proof the trousers or ties, that's made of nanotech materials, and so you're familiar with it. The other is abrasion-free or abrasion-proof sunglasses. Similarly, in the automotive industry, your bumpers or your pedestals, they use in the trucks and the like, and tiles and self-cleaning windows. and a lot of them in cosmetics, actually, and so the use of those in lotions and the like, and so they penetrate the skin, and so they keep your skin more moist, and so those are some of the examples that come to mind. And there's artificial skin now. They talked about that part of availability as such.
And in talking about this, the advantage of the things, is there any common facet to the things you could get done for these applications with nanotechnology that just could not be done before? I mean, well, maybe give an example of some of the products. What was the nanotechnology part which made the innovation possible?
I think when you start talking about nanotechnology, you know, the big elephant in the room really is microelectronics, which is currently practiced at a nanoscale. So when you look at a device, for example, you know, a transistor, the sort of defining feature of a transistor, which is the channel length, is roughly around 22 nanometers. Okay, so you know, microelectronics, or we still call it microelectronics, but electronics, as you see in your cell phone or in computers or whatever, is largely a nano-enabled product today. When you look at nanostructures, you can sort of break them down into zero-dimensional structures or particles, one-dimensional structures, wires, and two-dimensional structures, which might be surfaces. And you see these sorts of things in many different places. If you take particles, for example, from the most basic sort of application is one where you have your sunblock. It uses TiO2, titanium oxide particles, basically used to block out sun. But these particles are also used as sensors. They call quantum dots, and they're used to basically detect very, very fine processes going on at the nanoscale. Similarly, you can think in terms of nanoparticles that are being used for medical purposes. They absorb infrared light and might be used to basically kill tumors. In manufacturing, they are beginning, many industries are beginning to come out with what are known as nanocomposites, composite materials made with nanoparticles or nanostructures in them. One particular nanocomposite uses carbon nanotubes. Okay, so that brings us to wires. So these one-dimensional wires, they can give you lots and lots, very high mechanical strengths. You know, I hate to give this example, but very often people used to talk about a carbon nanotube space elevator. Okay,
the space elevator being the totally speculative at this point, right, idea of, instead of, say, taking a rocket ship to go up into into space, you could actually take an elevator up a few thousand miles, and do it that way. If you had, I guess, the building materials that were sufficiently strong and lightweight.
Yeah, and the point again there is to bring about the fact that some of these kinds of materials provide you with fantastic strength to weight ratios. That is to say, you can make something very strong while not necessarily making it very heavy or very big.
Not to the space elevator stage yet, but
I think that's just.
But there are some things we're doing now that we couldn't
right.
do with.
That's yeah.
So among the things that can come to my mind is filtration devices for water purification systems, and so you are able to track or filter out bacteria and other pathogens, which you may not have been able to do that. And so those are added advantages that you are able to bring because of working at the nanoscale.
Yeah, friend, in your particular field, what sort of things, I think you had mentioned pesticide applications in the past.
So again, so those are all developing technologies, and those are, so you can talk about encapsulated materials, encapsulated pesticides, so the delayed release of pesticide on demand, and so you would not be over applying pesticides. So those are the sort of the wish list that is being worked on currently.
Yeah. So there are these structures called core shell structures.
Core shell?
Shell
structures.
And essentially, when you're making these extremely small particles, you can have a chemical in the core and you can have a shell which basically allows you to regulate the amount of the core that seeps out. And so you can make highly controlled fertilizers, for example, but you can also use the same kinds of technologies for drug deliveries.
Okay, so this is something which might have an application in medicine and then again in agriculture.
So yeah, we generally the way the technology flows is from defense to space to medicine and then to agriculture and the general. And so that's how it is. So there is a lot of activity in the healthcare area where advanced drug delivery or gene delivery is occurring through some of these using loaded nanoparticles for that matter, and depending on what types of nanoparticles and the like.
Well, maybe this brings us to the workshop you'll be having tomorrow and Friday, because it sounds like those are the sort of things that people will be discussing, the things that you're right at the cutting edge of.
Yeah, so indeed, and that's sort of the signature event for the campus for over 11 years now. This is the 11th annual nanotechnology workshop on campus. And the whole idea of this workshop and any other activities around it is to have created a nanotechnology innovation ecosystem on campus. It's a large campus, and so people may or may not know who else is doing what. And so it is also a reason for bringing folks, both faculty, students, and staff on one platform and talk about their research.
So is this a workshop just to people mostly around the campus?
It is open to the general public, those who are interested. As one of the role of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology is not only promoting research and education and training, but to have outreach and create public awareness about the technology as we work on, and also to initiate this, what we call the pipeline. So we want to engineer interests among our next generation workforce in terms of both at the from the middle schoolers to high school, from K to 12 actually, to be interested in these sort of technologies, because these are the ones which will keep us competitive in future. And when we talk about these as the tools for advanced manufacturing, so that's where, but that learning has to take place, and that's where the role of this technology or these technology workshops comes into play. So over the years, we have also had high schoolers attend these workshops. And so it and they go through these poster sessions and the like. But what we have done over the period is have been able to create more of these centers which are federally funded, and have brought this to the campus on different focus areas. For example, on cellular and molecular mechanics and bio-nanotechnology funded by the National Science Foundation. Another one on the Midwest Cancer Nanotechnology Training Center funded by the National Institute of Health, or NCI. And as we were talking about, are among the first centers that came about the Nanomanufacturing Center.
Center for, give its full name, the Center for Nanoscale Chemical Electrical Mechanical Manufacturing Systems.
Exactly. So that was among the first ones in 2003. And at that time, the colleague Prasad Ferreira led that effort and had been the director. And since then, it has seen two other directors and has contributed significantly both in terms of research and also to be the foundational work for the advanced manufacturing talk that is currently going on in Washington and elsewhere in the country.
So it sounds like the workshop is sort of a testament to just the wide range of applications and people could be affected by and working with nanotechnology, that you're setting up a workshop that's aiming at a lot of disciplines throughout the university and maybe a lot of businesses throughout the community, as well as students who might be getting into this themselves.
Exactly. So there is industry component to it. So industry are involved. we have. And as you know, as Blessed just mentioned, so most of the nanotechnology has been in consumer electronics and the iPads and the cell phones and the like, and the chip manufacturers like Intel, and those will be there participating in the workshop. There's a panel discussion. We talks about how nanotechnology research and innovation and this industry-academia partnership is contributing towards that innovation, and to also put issues on the table in terms of the implications of the nanotechnology, what we call the societal implications of nanotechnology.
You know, I'm wondering, there's a school field trip peering at us through the studio window right now. Maybe a little young for the workshop, but for all we know, some of the folks visiting us today in the studio may be, say, science students at high school or college age who might be attending one of these workshops in future years. We're going to I want to take a short break right now. We'll be back with more about nanotechnology, its present and future. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back here on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guests are Irfan Ahmad and Placide Ferreira of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at the University of Illinois. They are holding their annual workshop for just about anybody interested in nanotechnology at the scholarly, our business, our even student scale. Irfan, what's the website they can go to find out?
So it's nano.illinois.edu.
Nano.illinois.edu. And I think the events will be held tomorrow at one location and then Friday at a second one.
Yeah, the first day is at the NCSA auditorium.
That's at the NCSA building on Clark Street.
Right, National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And then on Friday at the Micro and Nanotechnology Laboratory.
And that's over on Wright Street, not far from Green, I take it. Placide, I was wondering, I just wanted to ask you more about the disciplines involved, and I don't know how broad, how wide a net does a workshop like this cast?
Yeah, actually, it's quite a challenge. I mean, when you're dealing with nanotechnology, it's really a highly integrating sort of subject. You cannot systematically answer questions by doing what we've normally done, which is breaking things down into disciplines and deal with things in chemical engineering, where you're predominantly working with chemical potentials, chemical forces, or electrical engineering, where you're working primarily with, you know, charges and electrical forces, or mechanical engineering, which is primarily mechanical. When you're working at a nanoscale, it pretty much all those forces, whether they are mechanical, chemical, or electrical in origin, are pretty much the same. And so you have to bring everybody to the table. The second thing about the integration aspects of nanotechnology is that there are widespread applications, whether they be in physics, whether they be in chemistry, whether they be in biology, medicine, engineering, etc. So you really have to bring everybody to the table to identify these kinds of applications. And the last thing I wanted to say was, it's a fantastically inspiring topic, and it's wonderful to get young kids to start thinking about how do you work, how do you make something that is nine orders of magnitude smaller than your fingers. And so you can use it as a wonderful way to inspire kids about the kinds of issues that one has when you try to do these sorts of things.
We have a phone call now, and I want to go to Eric in Urbana on line one, and I think he has a question about one particular field of applications for nanotechnology. Eric, you're on the air on Focus.
Hi. I just want to make a comment, but then, of course, be glad to hear a response. Some of us believe that small molecule therapy, broad-spectrum antibiotics for microbial infections are running into a dead end, and that the way to get around that is by what's called RNA therapy, which has the capability to be much, much more specific and much more capable of being re-engineered as bacteria acquire resistance. But the problem, and everybody recognizes this in molecular biology, the problem has always been to be able to develop a delivery system that would protect the RNA, which is fragile if you can't get it intact to the place of where it's going to act. So we have a project supported by the National Institutes of Health to develop just such delivery systems for that specific purpose and test them in a couple of species of pathogenic microbes. So if this goes the way that we hope, and I actually dare to believe, sometime in the next, you know, couple of decades, we're going to solve the problem of side effects of broad-spectrum antibiotics and evolved resistance by microbes by, in fact, nano-engineered delivery systems for RNA therapy. So I think that's potentially a very big deal. It's not here yet, but the NIH is investing in it at right now.
Yeah, that's a good comment. On the mark.
I was just going to say, yes, this is precisely the sort of thing we were talking about, that, you know, there are so many different applications. And, you know, it's nice to see this. And, for example, you know, within the National Nanotechnology Initiative, bio-nanotechnology, which is what the caller just mentioned, is called out as a very specific, large part of nanotechnology.
Okay, so this is something that this the idea of delivery systems, in this case involving RNA, but anything when you wanted to need to deliver medication or anything to a specific part of the body or a specific part of the cell, this is where nanotechnology could play a role in developing the system to do that.
Yeah. I mean, exactly, and so is the bioavailability of these particles, which is the question, and then what are the what is the composition of these particles, and that is also critical because you are injecting materials into the body, and so they should not have adverse effects, and those are items of currently active research.
And this maybe this dovetails over to the social implication issues that you said the workshop will also be looking at, and I'm wondering if there are anything in particular that's on the say on the minds of researchers. Concerns may change from year to year, but what are people thinking about right now?
So the workshop does not have a specific session on the societal implications, but we have had these in the previous workshops. But among the things when we talk about societal implications, it is a plethora of things that we're talking about. So we're talking about healthcare aspects, we're talking about legal aspects, we're talking about environmental aspects, we are talking about global aspects and the like, and then the education and outreach. And so, for example, I'll give you an example of currently, the new generation of washing machines use some kind of nanoparticles to enhance the washing process. And so then these are then going into the waste waterways. And so some of the municipalities in the country are not geared or set up to handle that sort of waste. And so the issues on the table are, what is the life cycle of a nanoparticle, and how it goes through these different domains from water to soil to aerosolizing it. And so those are definitely concerns and again, areas of active interest, and those become the environmental aspects or the environmental implications of nanotechnology. And then NIOSH created a nanotechnology group. NIOSH is the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, and so they are talking about worker safety and the like. When folks are working on nanoparticles, do the nanoparticles actually impinge on the different organs, especially lungs and the like? And so there have been animal studies out of other universities which are trying to document that But so with any new technology, there has to be all of these discussions have to be on the table. And our role here is to actually put both the pros and the cons on the table. And so there are benefits of the technology, and there could be some aspects which we are not familiar with at this point in time.
Yeah, I was just going to say that lots of the properties and the reactivity and the behavior of a material is quite different when it's in the form of a nanoparticle versus when it's in bulk form. And that primarily comes from the large surface area and hence increased reactivity and so forth. And there's a good bit of research, actually, when this NNI was set up, they anticipated the need to properly test and properly understand what particular properties are associated with different types of nanoparticles, different sizes of nanoparticles, even different shapes of nanoparticles. So, you know, it's very different if you have a long wire versus you have a round sphere. And so there is a good bit of research going on, one at NIST, which tries to characterize the shapes and sizes and so forth of nanoparticles, and then at NIOSH, which basically looks at how it sort of changes the toxicity of the particles and so forth.
You know, I was wondering, we broadcast a show on WILL from NPR called Science Friday. And I was, in researching for this show, I came across a podcast from actually 6 years ago that my producer, Lindsay Moon, had pointed me to. And 6 years ago, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency was looking at questions about nanotechnology safety, really just beginning to look at those questions. I'm wondering, especially working in agriculture as you do, is there regulation of this field or at least observation by the U.S. EPA? Do you have to tell them what you're doing and at least let them see? Are there regulations you have to follow?
Yes, but it is all evolving. What you alluded to earlier, so the National Science Foundation and the EPA actually were instrumental in starting a center elsewhere in the country. And they are looking at some of the environmental implications of it. But per se, there has not been any regulatory standards come about, but those are being worked on. We just submitted another proposal to jointly to the NSF and EPA, and that exactly discusses some of these life cycle issues that I alluded to earlier.
Okay. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your questions about nanotechnology, a topic we discuss every now and then over the years on Focus. Our guests, Irfan Ahmad, making a fifth or sixth appearance on the program, and Placid Ferreira of the Center, both of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology at the University of Illinois. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455, toll free at 1-800-222-9455. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Have there been any dead ends, or if not dead ends, at least areas of slow going where people thought that some miracle or at least something dramatic was going to come out of nanotechnology and you're still waiting for it? Are there any big nuts out there to crack, or are there just some things that you don't think are going to happen?
I hate to call anything a dead end. I mean, there's always research runs into a wall for some time, and then it provides a perspective from which you attack a problem differently.
Well, where can you name a locked door that you're trying to figure out how to get through at this point? Maybe the field as a whole, that is.
Again, coming from a manufacturing perspective, we are quite successful in terms of making bulk particles, nanoparticles, or, you know, carbon nanotubes and so forth. But when it comes to sort of manufacturing nanostructures on large areas, okay, let's say not the couple of millimeters or a couple of centimeters that you have on an electronic chip, but think in terms of your solar panel, and you'd like to put nanostructures to capture or to increase the efficiency of capturing light. Now, to make that very efficient and to make that highly controlled and very repeatable, these are still challenges, and people are still looking at how do you develop these sorts of processes so that they are cost effective, they are highly repeatable, and they can be deployed on a highly scalable or large scale kind of format.
So somebody who is able to make a breakthrough in that area is going to get a lot of attention.
I'm sure you'll get a lot of attention. That, you know, you'd be as successful, I suppose, as successful as solar is these days.
So, yeah, so the scale-up issues are definitely the holding block. And it's another thing to show a phenomena or a result in a lab situation, but to do it at a mass scale is a different ball game. And also, because we do not have some of the manufacturing infrastructure in place to make some of these devices or materials at the nanoscale, and so those are again an ongoing activities that have to come about, and that's why there is focus from at the national level in creating these pockets or these hubs, so to speak, in advanced manufacturing at different places across the country to get this momentum going and leverage on the research done in these manufacturing centers and take it to the next level. And that pretty much would ensure our competitiveness across the world and also keep us ahead in the game, so to speak.
Who is... U.S. competitiveness. Who's the big rival when it comes to nanotechnology?
So my bet is that there are so many overarching issues and global challenges which no single country or no single institution or no single discipline can address. So we see it in a collaborative manner. So in terms of looking at. So we partner both academically and otherwise with both industry and academia across the country and across the world. But in terms of investments, the more recently, actually the developing countries and some of the other developed countries have really put in a lot of funds, and they see this as the next big innovation hub and an economic engine for their economies. And so directly to answer your question, we are talking about South Korea, we are talking about China, we are talking about Japan, we are talking about South Africa, and so you name it. I mean, so almost everyone who has scoping the future is looking at nanotechnology closely. In this country, since President Clinton signed the initiative about 10, 15 years ago, has invested about $18 billion or thereabout in different agencies to advance the development of nanotechnology research and also now more focus on the societal implication. Because you do not want to go the route of biotechnology, which again was a very promising and is continues to be a promising good technology, but got a bad rap because there was less awareness among the public, and especially in Europe and in developing countries about that. And so you don't want to go there. So that's why you want to bring the general public in these discussions while you are researching on some of these topics.
Mm-hmm. We have an emailed question about graphene, which the writer says has gotten a lot of attention recently. Yeah. Is there any work at the U of I on graphene and other two-dimensional materials, and where do you think this material will have its first impact?
Yes, there's quite a lot of work.
And maybe we should start by explaining what graphene is exactly.
Well, when you look at graphite, you can think of graphite as being made of these very thin monolayers of carbon atoms that are arranged in the hexagonal shapes. And graphene is one, you can think of as one of those layers. So it's a sort of monolayer of few layers of carbon atoms arranged in that hexagonal shape. Another way to think of graphene is to think in terms of a carbon nanotube, which is, again, you know, if you had a single-walled carbon nanotube, you have one layer of carbon atoms, and that is unrolled or unfolded into a sheet. So that's what people call graphene. And graphene has a lot of applications, some in electronics, certainly quite a lot of applications in sensors and very, very sort of sensitive and very specific sensors, just because of your ability to work with one layer or a two-dimensional nanomaterial. Within University of Illinois, there are quite a few people who was actually studying the properties of graphene, but even in mechanical engineering, we have people working on synthesis of graphene development. For example, we have a person by the name of Seungwoo Nam, who's working on integration of graphene graphite, which makes it possible to connect graphene to a more sort of handleable material called graphite. And so you have very good electrical contact as well as good mechanical contact.
Yeah, so there are colleagues at Beckman Institute,
right,
who are working on graphene and others in other labs also. I wanted to allude to one other center that we have, which is a remarkable example of industry-academia partnership. It's what it's an NSF center. It's called the Industry University Cooperative Research Center, and that is a Center for Agriculture, Biomedical, and Pharmaceutical Nanotechnology. And that, again, you had raised the question of how does agriculture come into play in this. So here, in this case, is the particular center is looking at agricultural-derived products for pharmaceutical applications using nanotechnology. And while we're going about doing that, this has a more of a translational nature. That means that from the get-go, the faculty and the graduate students are working with industry directly, and the industry then again come from different segments of the industrial sector. And so not only biotechnology companies, but also nanotechnology companies, ag and food companies, and then consortiums are involved who pay for having this research conducted, and then come up with enhanced development of a product or the totally diversification of a product.
I wanted to touch on, you know, we were talking before we went on the air about that Michael Crichton novel, The Prey, which, if you ever come across it, is about a swarm of nanorobots that sort of get out loose and start attacking people. Not going to happen, as far as I know, but there is a field of, there is research being done in nanorobotics. What are we talking about in the real world when we say nanorobotics?
Okay, this is a difficult one, but for example, you can have very small magnetic particles, and you can manipulate the motion of these magnetic particles with external magnetic fields. So here is an example where you can then have these magnetic particles carry molecules and arrange, you know, and bring them into different arrangements. That's one sort of very practical way of moving things around at the nanoscale. People call them robotics. Some people talk about molecular robotics and protein, protein ratchets and so forth. And these are actually using the structure of a molecule or typically a large molecule to make very specific bindings and actually move or traverse on other molecules or other long molecules, and thereby conducting some sort of chemical transport over fairly long distances.
Okay. We're going to have to bring it off there. It's nice to know that they're not going to swarm and go after us.
So that was exactly what you had raised earlier, is the societal implications. And so that's why you want to allay those fears, because there are the naysayers who want to put a moratorium on nanotechnology research, and then there are others who think that nanotechnology will solve the entire problems of the world. And so where is the truth? The truth is somewhere in between. So as researchers, as academics, it is our role to under-promise and over-deliver.
Okay. Well, I wish you luck in that. We've been talking today about nanotechnology. Our guests, Irfan Hamad and Placide Ferreira of the University of Illinois Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology, which is holding its annual nanotechnology workshop tomorrow and Friday. Go to nano.illinois.edu to find out more. It is open to anyone interested in nanotechnology. And I want to thank both of you for being on Focus today.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Welcome. Any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, go to it at will.illinois.edu/focus or Google Will Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon, other members of our Focus team, Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director. Tomorrow on Focus, vinyl records, the ones you play with a needle and a turntable, should have been buried by CDs and music downloads, but right now vinyl sales are making a comeback. Tomorrow on Focus, we talk with writers and a record store owner about what makes vinyl attractive in the 21st century for listeners and musicians. This is Focus on WILL.